All right, there, it's working. I can see it. All right, Ezekiel, we were in chapter 3 last week, and as we started chapter 3, we saw that Ezekiel had received his call to prophetic office, and that was completed. And we noted that a very heavy discipline was hanging over Ezekiel, a unique discipline. No other prophet had been told straightforwardly that the death penalty was hanging over his head for dereliction of duty. Nobody else has ever been told that. And so this commission is specifically for him. And I got to ask some questions. Well, why? Why in the world would God single him out in this way? And we really don't know because God doesn't say. But if we back up to chapter 2, verse 8, this might be the reason. Remember back in chapter 2, verse 8, Ezekiel was warned against prophetic rebellion. Now you, son of man, listen to what I am speaking to you. Do not be rebellious like that rebellious house. So this might be the reason why this pressure is put on him. I expect you to fulfill his commission, no matter what. So I wouldn't go to the wall for that, but that is a possibility. Now, with this idea of prophetic rebellion in mind, even though no other prophet was told that you have the death penalty hanging over your head if you fail your commission, there are two examples of prophets who did suffer the death penalty for disobedience. And one example, can anyone guess? Anyone know the rebellious prophet who ended up in the Jonah? I see you mouthing that. Read my lips, right? Yeah, Jonah. Jonah was told to go east to Nineveh. Instead, Jonah went west to Tarshish and ended up in the ocean and drowned, right? But he was unique in that the Lord resurrected him and gave him a second shot at the commission. So that was rather unique. There was also the disobedient prophet in 1 Kings 13. He went to Bethel and he preached against the altar there. And then he was deceived into disobedience by another prophet. He was told, go home by another route, don't eat any food, drink any water there in the northern kingdom. And another prophet came and said, an angel told me that you're supposed to come and have dinner at my house. You know, remember that, the deceived prophet? So he suffered the death penalty too, but he was deceived into disobedience. So believers today do not have the death penalty hanging over our head if we don't warn somebody of their sin. You know, there's no verse in the New Testament that says, if you don't witness, God will get you. You know, I'll get you if you do that. Nothing says that. We don't have that hanging over our head. But I'm going to do the Reb Tevye thing in Fiddle on the Roof. But on the other hand, we are all under a solemn and serious commission. What commission is that? Great commission, right? All right. And now in light of this review, I'm going to hand out our applications. This is going to be a little more extended review than I normally do. But all the verses that I'll put up on the overhead are, let's see, I'm going to cool this place down a little bit. It's too cool? Some people are hot, some are cool. Okay. All right. Whoops. I need to get some more back there. All right, is there any extras here? I'll make sure that back row gets them. Don't worry, we'll make sure. I just handed them out in an uneven manner. Okay. All right, got enough here. And extras, okay, yeah, back row needs them. You guys, 1, 2, 3. And anyone missing one? Okay, there's 3 over there. Okay, how many do you need? You need one or two more? One more, okay. Everybody have one? I've got 4 left over. Boy, I'm glad I did some extras. All righty. Now, all I'm going to talk about, and if you need these extras, they're in the supplementary notes notebook up here. They'll be put at the back. All righty. Now, in reference to the Great Commission, here it is. In Matthew 28, 18 through 20, Yeshua is speaking, and Yeshua came up and spoke to them, saying, all authority has been given to me in heaven and earth, and that's our right to go to any place in the world with the good news of the Messiah. All authority has been given me. And then here's the commission. Go therefore and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to observe all that I commanded you. So that's the very solemn and serious commission we are under. Now let's continue on in the verse. Yeshua says, "Lo, I am with you always." That's our empowerment. Just as Ezekiel needed to be empowered to fulfill his commission by the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, the Ruach HaKodesh, so we do, and we have that. So he is with us to empower us to fulfill that commission, and he finishes up even to the end of the age. And this brings the commission down to us today and beyond us to the end of the church age. So that's the commission we're under. Now there is a procedure to follow as we implement the Great Commission, and that's brought out by Paul in Romans 1:16. "For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek." So wherever we go throughout the world, we're not to forget God's chosen people. We're to tell the Jewish community, and we're scattered all over the world today. We're even in Antarctica. Did you know that?
Really?
Jewish people are even in Antarctica. No? Haven't you guys heard of the icebergs?
Oh.
That's an old one. All right. I got it. It's chutzpah. It's called chutzpah. All right. We're all over the world, and as we go all over the world, we're to remember the Jewish community. That's what Paul did in the book of Acts. Whenever he went out into the Roman Empire, he always went to the synagogue first. Always went to the synagogue first, proclaiming the good news of the Messiah. All righty. Now, the need for obedience, however, to this commission we've been given is implied in Paul's comments in Acts 20, 26, and 27. He says, "Therefore I testify to you this day that I am innocent of the blood of all men." Sounds like he might have been reading Ezekiel there. "For I did not shrink from declaring to you the whole purpose of God." So basically he says, I fulfilled my responsibility there. And so we're to do the same thing. We're not going to lose our life if we're poor evangelists, but also we're not to shrink back from the opportunities that God gives us. Not to shrink back from that. Now, with all that said, this issue came up in the morning class. And so it seemed to be an important issue to them, so we'll go through this issue in the evening class here too. Now, with all this said, believers today can suffer the death penalty for willful, deliberate, and habitual sinning. We can. We can experience capital punishment today. And the process begins with the church restoration procedure of Matthew 18, verses 15 through 17. This is a four-step procedure that ends in excommunication. Here's step one, Matthew 18, 15. "If your brother sins, go and show him his fault in private. If he listens to you, you've won your brother." So if there's an issue develops, it's supposed to be dealt with on a private basis first. And believe me, folks, 99% of all our issues are taken care of right here. Nobody else has to know about it except you and the person that the issue is with. But most people don't follow this. And most churches don't talk about this at all. But I've seen the majority of issues taken care of right here. Okay? Well, you go talk with your brother or your sister, and the issue is not resolved. There's some kind of moral problem going on, so what's the next step? But if he does not listen to you, take one or two more with you, so that by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every fact may be confirmed. So now the private scope of the issue goes semi-private. Two or three more people are brought in, and there's a lot more to be said than what I'm saying here. But they're brought in to just make sure this doesn't get into a he said, she said thing. You know, Jacob said this, and Johnny said this, and who knows where the truth lies. You know, so they come in, they investigate all that's going on, and try to come to a decision about what's going on. Is it a true issue or isn't it? Well, if they come to the conclusion that it is a true moral issue, and they confront Jacob, what does Jacob do? He can either submit to their decision, their counsel, or he can refuse. And if he refuses to listen to them, now if he submits to it, of course, and does away with his sin, makes it right, it's over with. But if he refuses to listen to them, what do? You tell it to the church. Now, I've come to the conclusion that the word church here is a reference to the leadership. You would take it to the leadership of the synagogue in Yeshua's day, or take it to the leadership of the church, the elders. And they, the semi-private scope is now expanded a little bigger, and you get a little more objective people involved. These are, if they're leadership of the church, they're supposed to be godly people who are looking out for the benefit of both parties, investigate it thoroughly, see if they can resolve the issue. If they resolve the issue, great. If they don't, Yeshua says, if he refuses to listen even to the church, if the issue is thoroughly investigated and the leadership says, Jacob, you're still in the wrong, you need to get this right, what's the reaction? Let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. Now, what does that mean? Well, in the first century Jewish community, the way you relate, what this means is that you treated a Gentile and tax collector, you had as little to do with them as possible. That's the idea. A tax collector was a trader who worked for Rome, and if you had to pay your taxes to him, okay. But then you had as little to do with him as possible. Same thing with a Gentile, a Roman soldier, something like that. That this is excommunication. Yes, you had some interaction. That was is normal in life. But other than that, you said sorry. You're out of the church. Now, in modern 21st century America, in the American church, this seems rather inconsequential. Why? Because there's another church down the block, right? Oh, you don't like me here? Meh. Heck with you, I'll go down to church B down the block there, and I'll just disappear in there, and it's all over with. Well, that wasn't the sense in the first century. In the first century, there wasn't a church down the block. But in America in the 21st century, there is. But this is still no laughing matter, because there's more to it than simple excommunication. Because being put out of the church implies that you're also being put under the power of Satan. And this is on page 2 of your handout there. Now, normally, God determines the length of our lives. You know, normally, it's God who will take our lives. I have a friend who's right now dying of kidney failure. He's going to be gone in a few days. The Lord knows exactly when his life is going to be over. He's going to step into the presence of the Lord, okay? But when you're handed over to the power of Satan, then Satan is allowed to inflict premature death if he desires to do so. He may or may not. Example is 1 Corinthians 5, 1 through 5. Paul's writing to the brand new church in Corinth, and he's rebuking them, the congregation in Corinth. He says, it is actually reported that there is immorality among you, and immorality of such a kind that does not exist even among the Gentiles, that someone has his father's wife. So in Corinth, we have some gross immorality among the believers there, some incest. And how is the congregation in Corinth responding to that? Well, they're responding exactly the way the church in 21st century America responds. This could be written to 21st century America. You have become arrogant and have not mourned instead, so that the one who has done this deed, would be removed from your midst. He says, you see, this guy, instead of tolerating immorality, you know, tolerance is fine as long as it's in non-moral areas, you know. Guy wants to wear his hair long, or girl wants to change her hair color, you know, so what? You tolerate non-moral things, but tolerance of moral issues and doctrinal problems is a wrong, you know. We throw morality out the window and say, well, so what? That's wrong. Scripture doesn't allow for that. So these people have been tolerating this immorality among them. And Paul says, you should have done the church restoration procedure. You should have removed this guy from your midst. You should have been disciplined. He goes on to say, verse 5, I have decided to deliver such a one to Satan. He's using apostolic authority here. For what? Delivered to Satan for what? The destruction of his flesh, so that his spirit may be saved in the day of our Lord Yeshua. Okay? So the penalty here is potential death penalty for this individual. Notice his salvation is secure. His eternal state is secure. His spirit may be saved. Okay, but he may lose his life. He may lose his life for deliberate, willful, and consistent sinning. That's a possibility. Okay, do you see what's happening here? And this church has not dealt with this person the way they should. So this is for moral problems. Another example is in 1 Timothy, 1 Timothy 1:18 through 20. Here we read, "This command I entrust to you, Timothy, my son, in accordance with the prophecies previously made concerning you, that by them you fight the good fight, keeping faith and a good conscience," that's in other words, living a moral, righteous life, "which some have rejected and suffered shipwreck of their faith." Now, there's some people in Timothy's congregation who are throwing morality to the winds. Who are they? Among these, next verse, now there's a number of them, but two are named. "Among these are Hymenaeus and Alexander, whom I have handed over to Satan, so that they will be taught not to blaspheme." So the issue here is doctrinal error, blasphemy, what is wrong, what is morally wrong. And so what has Paul done here? Again, we have a potential death penalty hanging over these people's head because they're not being dealt with. I mean, Paul is dealing with them, okay? See what I'm saying? Any questions on that? Yes.
Well, during the, excommunication, so to speak, would they physically force them to leave the church?
Yeah, you're to have nothing to do with them. If you excommunicated somebody from a synagogue, they were out. And you had as little to do with them as you possibly could. Yeah, same parallel. Yeah, you should ask a person to leave the congregation. Okay? So, the death penalty is a possibility for us today, but what's the purpose of going through all this stuff? Why are we going through this? God just mean? Just want to hit us with a big stick? No, that's not the purpose. The purpose is brought out in 2 Thessalonians 3. If anyone does not obey our instruction, and the issue here is rejecting good doctrine. Hi, you guys, come on in. We've got some seats over here. Do you guys need a notebook? No, you have a notebook. Okay, do you need another notebook? You're okay? Okay, a couple seats, a bunch of seats here in front. Hi. All right, if anyone does not obey our instruction in this letter, and take special note of that person, and what? Do not associate with him. There's the step four of the church restoration procedure. Why do you not associate with that person? So that he will be put to shame. You know, we're supposed to be ashamed of immorality. You know, that doesn't exist in America today. There was, in my generation, people were ashamed of the stuff they do openly now. Okay? But God's saying, you're supposed to deal with the person, and it's supposed to hurt. Being put out of your local congregation is supposed to hurt. You know, tough love. We call it tough love today, okay? Now he goes on. "Yet do not regard him as an enemy." See, the purpose here is to not step on people and squash them like a bug. We're not dealing with enemies here. "But admonish him as a brother." The idea is to bring Jacob back to righteous living. That's the idea here. You know, so you're walking down the grocery store aisle and you see Jacob and you say, "Hi, Jacob, how you doing?" And he says, "Well, hey, why don't we go have lunch together?" "Well, Jacob, wait a second now. What about that girl you've been shacking up with, are you still doing that?" "Yeah, I am." "Well, sorry, Jacob, can't do that with you, So you want him to repent of his sin, or that gal, or whatever. "You still doing drugs?" "Yeah, I am." "Well, I'm sorry." But if Jacob or Janie or whoever comes back to the congregation and says, "Listen, it hurts too much. I want to walk with the Lord. I want to walk in a righteous way." You welcome them back in. You restore a brother or sister. Because that's who you're dealing with, a brother or sister. And you want to restore them back to righteous living. That's the whole idea behind this. Okay, make sense? And I know this isn't taught in most churches. Most churches ignore this. But it's too important. And that's why the issue came up in this morning's class. Let's see, where am I? Okay. So back to Ezekiel. After our little, there is a little bit of a chart on the handout that we're going to get to in just a moment here. So back to Ezekiel. Ezekiel has a unique calling. He's the only prophet who's told point blank from the beginning that you have the death penalty hanging over your head for dereliction of duty. And we're very grateful that in the age of grace, under the church, we don't have that kind of a penalty hanging over our heads. We can, if we really get wild in our sinning, suffer it, but in general, we're okay. And by the way, did you notice your salvation is secure? I do believe in eternal security, that a believer can get into gross sin, even suffer premature death, but not lose their salvation. Oh, I would think that would agree. Yeah, if you're living a life of sin and you're saying, you're taking communion saying, oh yeah, I'm remembering what Jesus did for me, that's hypocrisy, isn't it? You know, we should thank him for what he's done for us and that he's taken the penalty for our sin. And
but many sleep as well.
Oh yeah, that was the problem in Corinth. Yeah, Corinth, they were taking it in an unworthy manner, not only casually, but probably sin issues like this as well. Yeah. So communion is a solemn and serious ordinance that we should pay attention to and not take in a haphazard and relaxed, casual way. You know, it cost Yeshua a tremendous amount of suffering. The God-man had to go through a tremendous amount of suffering for us, for the junk that we do. You know, if we don't appreciate that, there's something wrong with us. There really is. It really is. All righty. Moving on to chapter 4. That's a long review of the end of chapter 3. But as we moved on into chapter 3, continuing on in chapter 3, we came to the prophecies of judgment on Judah. And Ezekiel is told that he would be bound, that he wouldn't be able to speak. He had some more. His tongue would cleave to the mouth of his roof unless if he tried to speak. He would only be able to speak when God spoke. You know, heavy-duty stuff here. So I'm going to how his wife reacted to all that. You know, he had to do things with sign language. She was probably happy, right. And he had to he was also told that he would have to perform symbolic actions. And in chapter 4, we moved into those symbolic actions, 4 symbolic actions that would validate him as a genuine prophet. And as far as the time frame goes, chapters 1 through 3 dealt with Ezekiel's present time as he received his commission to become a prophet, pretty heavy-duty commission. As we moved into chapter 4, we moved into the near future. We'll see some short-term and mid-term prophecies that will validate Ezekiel as a true prophet. Now, the first sign that he was to portray was the sign of the tile, the sign of the brick. He was to take a clay tablet, like this Babylonian clay tablet, and draw a picture of Jerusalem on it, put it in the middle of his room. Then he was to build a siege picture all around it. He was to make a clay model of siege ramps and battering rams and armies surrounding Jerusalem. And the point of all this was that there was going to be the fact of a siege. The false prophets were saying, not to worry, it's never going to happen. But Jeremiah and Ezekiel were both saying, Jeremiah in Judah, Ezekiel in Babylon, both saying, nope, Babylon's coming. And so when this happens, it'll be shown who is the true prophet. Then came the sign of the posture. He was to lay on his left side for 390 days and then lie on his right side for another 40 days, for 340 days. And that was to portray the bearing of the sins of Israel. And we looked at various interpretations regarding what that meant. And on page 57, in the middle of the page of your outline, point E, I presented to you the final interpretation of, out of 5, that the date of this lying on his side, this 340-year period that he's talking about, probably lies in Israel's future and is probably dated from 586 to 156, the fall of Jerusalem, till the establishment of the Maccabean kingdom. And I do think that is the best way to look at it. And the point is the duration of punishment, the time when Israel would be under domination by the Gentiles after the fall of Jerusalem. Now, I got asked in the morning class, what does this bearing the consequences of sin mean? And this is the way I explained it to you guys last week. So I wrote it down for them this week, and I put it on your outline, on your handout there. The right and left sides of Ezekiel's body suffered extreme discomfort bearing the weight of his body during the symbolic 430-day period. You know, he laid on one side, it got probably pretty sore ribs, okay? This wasn't constant, but it was pretty uncomfortable. In the same manner, the entire nation would bear the consequences of sin, and the consequences are the extreme discomfort of Gentile domination during a 430-year period in the midst of the times of the Gentiles. From 586 BC, when Jerusalem was destroyed by Babylon, until 156 BC and the reestablishment of self-government. Now, I've charted that out for you, and this chart is in the bottom of your handout. So the sign of the posture deals with the duration of punishment. Israel will suffer total domination by the Gentiles starting in 586 BC with the Babylonian destruction. It would last 430 years. That would take us through the three of the four kingdoms that Daniel talks about, the Babylonian era, the Persian era, and the Greek era. These are the first four Gentile kingdoms that will affect Israel. Then in 156 BC, the rebellion against the Greek Empire was successful, and we have the establishment of the Maccabean Kingdom. That lasted from 156 BC to 63 BC, approximately 90 years. And this is an era of temporary and of Jewish autonomy, but temporary Jewish autonomy. In 63 BC, Pompey would come in. He would conquer Jerusalem, and the Roman era would begin. The final kingdom of Daniel would come and dominate the Jewish people, and that kingdom will last until the Messianic kingdom. So we are in this period from 63 BC up till the present, up till the Messianic kingdom, in fact. Okay? There's where we were. Extended review. Okay, are we ready to move on? Did that make sense, all of that? Was it worth it?
Yeah.
I hope it was worth it. And the day class thought it was great. They really went into this. We had a long discussion of all of this. All right. Okay, let's pick it up then in the middle of page 57 on your outline. We come to the third sign, the sign of defiled bread. The sign of defiled bread. And I only have a couple of minutes to start on this. We'll get started on it. Let's at least do verse 9. We begin in verse 9, and Ezekiel is given a bread recipe. Chapter 4, verse 9. Everybody there? Okay, here comes the bread recipe. But as for you, take wheat, barley, beans, lentils, millet, and spelt, put them in one vessel and make them into bread for yourself. You shall eat it according to the number of days that you lie on your side, 390 days. So you see the recipe laid out for you. He puts it in some kind of a mixing bowl, adds whatever you ladies add to all that stuff. I don't know what you do. And he makes bread. Now, at the break, which will happen in just a few moments, I did bring out the rest of the Ezekiel 4:9 bread out there. So it is out in the back. And you can have, Kiara brought some jam. I got some butter. So you can have Ezekiel 4:9 bread during your break. But if you eat it, you got to lay on your left side. Okay? I want to, all right. Everybody come out. I want to see everybody on the ground there. Okay. All right, page 58. Page 58. Point D at the top of the page. So he's to eat this bread for D1 there, 390 days. D2, it was to be his major food during the time he's lying on his left side. Now at this point, critics say that Ezekiel broke the Mosaic Law. That God ordered him to break the Mosaic Law. And they quote Leviticus 19:19, point parentheses 1 there, double parentheses 1 and double parentheses 2 as evidence. We'll look at those verses in just a moment. But point E, single right-hand parentheses E, such a mixture was forbidden insofar as sowing was concerned, but not as far as eating or cooking. All right? So here's those verses. And you'll see, Leviticus 19:19. You are to keep my statutes. You shall not breed together two kinds of cattle. You shall not sow your field with two kinds of seed, nor wear garment upon you of two kinds of material mixed together. Okay, it's just mixing seed in a field. You'd have your barley field here, your wheat field here, your spelt field here. That's all it's talking about. Doesn't talking about cooking, nothing about cooking there. And then Deuteronomy 22:9. You shall not sow your vineyard with two kinds of seeds. So if you plant grapes, your vineyard, don't mix wheat in with it. Or the produce of the seed which you have sown and the increase of your vineyard will become defiled. So they're talking strictly about sowing here, nothing about cooking. So God is not commanding Ezekiel to break the Mosaic law here. And I don't know why the critics come up with this, but they're really stretching in order to do that. All right, I've taken us a minute or so over. So we'll have about a 10-minute break tonight. So go ahead and take your break, listen for the shofar, and we'll come back and pick it up with verse 10. All right, there we go. Let's get back here. All right, let's pick it up. Let's pick it up then in the middle of page 58. Middle of page 58. We've seen that Ezekiel is going to make this bread. And by the way, I was told if this bread was not made with some yeast, it'd be like a little hardtack. It'd be a lump there. So I don't know if he added yeast to it or not. All right, verse 10. Verse 10. Why is he to make this bread? And so now the idea of rationing food comes to the fore in verse 10. Chapter 4, verse 10. Your food which you eat shall be 20 shekels a day by weight. You shall eat it from time to time. Now, as you can see, point A, parentheses 1 and 2, commentators are not quite sure exactly how much a shekel would be. But I consulted seven other commentators, and they all basically came down to between 8 and 10 ounces of coarse bread a day. Now, the loaf that I had out there were, I think, 24 ounces. So about a third of a loaf of bread a day is what Ezekiel is to eat. So that's not a big banquet, is it? And point three is the idea, scarcity of food. And this is one of the curses of the covenant. Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 outline the blessings and cursings of the Mosaic covenant. And in verse 26 of Leviticus 26, this is one of the curses. When I break your staff of bread, 10 women will bake your bread in one oven. They're going to be small loaves. You're going to be able to fit in there. And they will bring back your bread in rationed amounts so that you will eat and not be satisfied. So when we break the Mosaic covenant, we will experience severe rationing during the warfare that comes upon us. So that's the idea. Ezekiel is to portray the rationing that's going to come upon Jerusalem when Babylon surrounds the city. In verse 11, we come to the idea of a water ration. The water you drink will be the sixth part of a hin by measure. You shall drink it from time to time. Now, a hin of water is a little more accurately determined. Point double parentheses 2 there. 1/6 of a hin would be about 2 pints of water a day, about a quart of water a day. Now, I have up here a 24-ounce bottle of water, so it would be just a little bit more than this for the whole day. Not a lot of water in a hot climate, not a lot of water. So not a lot of bread and not a lot of water. A third of a loaf of bread, a quart of water, that's what he's to eat during the day. So we have Ezekiel 4:9 bread in the back. I thought I would start the Ezekiel 4:9 diet. So I think you'll lose weight on this diet, whether you exercise or not. You think this will be a winner? Think I ought to do this? I don't know. I'll make millions, yeah. I'll be the Ezekiel 4:9 diet guru here. All right, so he's going to be very, very scarce rations. Page 59. Question. We'll get to that in just a little bit. The explanation will come a little bit further on here. All right, the manner in which he's to eat these rations, verse 12. You shall eat it as a barley cake, having baked it in their sight over human dung. Now, he bakes these small cakes, and they would be just small little barley cakes. And it's baked in the sight of the people. because the lesson is for them. This is to teach something. Now, don't get confused. Point C. He's not being told to add human dung to the recipe. Human dung here is used as the fuel. Okay? It's the fuel. Now, there is nothing in scriptures that prevents the use of this kind of fuel, but it was considered unclean. And so in the people's mind, if you cooked food with this type of fuel, you would render it ritually unclean. And so that issue comes to the fore here in the next verse or two. Verse 13, now we have the application of all this. Verse 13. Then the Lord said, thus shall the sons of Israel eat their bread unclean among the nations, where I will banish them. And so the idea here is that there's going to be a siege of Jerusalem. There's going to be a famine in Jerusalem. Jerusalem will be taken. The people living in the land will be exiled to Babylon, and they will eat defiled food during this whole period, of siege and exile. Now, this kind of takes Ezekiel aback. Remember, he's a priest. He's also a godly man. He's been living in conformity to the Mosaic law all his life, and this kind of shocks him. So we pick up his surprise in verse 14. But I said, ah, Lord God, behold, I have never been defiled, for from my youth until now I have never eaten what died of itself, or was torn by beasts, or has had any unclean, or has any unclean meat ever entered my mouth. So he begins point C1 at the bottom of the page there with an exclamation of protest. This is an exclamation of protest. O Lord Jehovah. He says, my soul has not been polluted. So he's lived a godly life in conformity with the Mosaic law for 30 years. He's probably 30 years old here, as we saw earlier in our study. And then he mentions three types of food that he's never eaten. Point A at the bottom. I have not eaten that which dies of itself. He's only eaten meat that has been from a slaughtered animal. Okay, so anything that died of old age, anything that died of disease, anything like that, he hasn't touched. And that is in keeping with the Mosaic law, and you see the three cross-references there, Leviticus 7, Leviticus 22, Deuteronomy 14. Okay, that's the first type of meat he has never touched. Going on to page 60, he mentions another type of meat. He's never eaten that which is, point B, at the top of the page, torn of beasts. In other words, he's never eaten an animal killed by another animal. Never eaten the remnants of a sheep killed by the wolves or by a lion or anything like that. Or a cow killed by a lion. Never eaten anything like that. And that was forbidden by the Mosaic law. Also, you see your cross-references, Exodus 22, Leviticus 7, Leviticus 22. And then he mentions a third type of meat. Point C. Neither came there abominable flesh into my mouth. Now, this does not refer to unkosher meat like pork. He's not referring to that. He uses a technical term here that speaks of sacrificial meat that is 3 days or more old. So this is clean meat, because it's a sacrificial animal, like a lamb, something like that, but it's more than 3 days old. It's a technical term. Here it is in Leviticus 7:18. Now, the term is pigul, if any of you are interested in the Hebrew. Pigul, P-I-G-G-U-L. Pigul would be a good way to transliterate it. For example, Leviticus 7:18. If any of the flesh of the sacrifice of his peace offering, see, this is clean meat, it's a sacrificial peace offering, a shelamim. So if any of the flesh of the sacrifice of his peace offering should ever be eaten on the third day, he who offers it will not be accepted, and it will not be reckoned to his benefit. It shall be an offensive thing. and the person who eats it will bear his own iniquity. So that's a violation of Mosaic law. Also Leviticus 19:7, the other verse. So if it is eaten at all on the third day, it is an offense. It will not be accepted, as a sacrifice there. So that's what he's talking about. He's not talking about pork. He's talking about sacrificial meat. All right, point four, middle of the page. Notice, actually, cooking with human dung was not, and cross out sacrificially, put in, I think the word should be specifically. I think that's a typo there. I think that's an error. Cooking with human dung was not specifically forbidden by the law of Moses. There's nothing that says you cannot use this fuel. But our God is a gracious God. And so he very graciously listens to Ezekiel and provides for his scruples. Verse 15. Then he said to me, "See, I shall give you cow's dung in place of human dung over which you will prepare your bread." So he's not asking Ezekiel to violate the Mosaic law. He's not asking Ezekiel to violate his conscience, even. He's very, very cognizant of that this would violate Ezekiel's conscience. And so cow's dung was very acceptable as to use as fuel, and it still uses fuel, point two, by the Arabs today. All right, now let's apply all of this. Let's apply all of this symbolic actions that Ezekiel's gone through. Verse 16. "Moreover, he said to me, 'Son of man, behold, I am going to break the staff of bread in Jerusalem, and they will eat bread by weight and with anxiety, and drink water by measure and in horror.'" There it comes. Very clearly, here's the application. And again, that's Leviticus 26:26. If we disobey God and continue to disobey him, eventually he will bring siege upon our cities, and he will break our staff of bread, and we will experience famine in the cities. And so Jerusalem will experience a famine. Moving to page 61, at the top of the page, just as Ezekiel had to measure out his bread very carefully and eat it by weight, so they will have to do that, and they will also eat it in fearfulness, fear of starvation. They will be afraid of starvation when they eat this meager meal each day. And the same is true with the water. Ezekiel had to measure out the water that he would drink, a quart of water a day. And so the people in Jerusalem will have the same problem, and they will drink it in dismay, of death by dehydration. So starvation and dehydration will stock the city. Water supplies, food supplies will be giving out. Verse 17. "Because bread and water will be scarce, and they will be appalled with one another and waste away in their iniquity." Now, point B, it says they will be dismayed with one another. That's kind of a weak translation. The word, the Hebrew word underlying the translation dismayed means to, it means to look at one another with amazement, to be numbed by the sight that you see, to be appalled by the sight that you see. That's what the word dismayed means. To look at one another and be numbed, amazed, and appalled, because the people are going to be skin and bones. It's not going to be a pretty sight. And then point C, God says, they will pine away in their iniquity. Now that word pine away, you know, makes it sound like they're going to cry. You know, they're going to be sad. You know, that's the way we kind of use that word. But again, it's a weak translation. The Hebrew word underlying the translation pine away would better be translated rot away. Rot away. They will be skin and bones. The word is used this way in Leviticus 26:39, which is your cross-reference there. And there, in the New American Standard, it's translated pretty well. Leviticus 26:39, So those of you who may be left will rot away because of their iniquity in the lands of your enemies, and shall also, because of their iniquities of their forefathers, they will rot away with them. That's the same term. Severe famine. And you know, we have experienced this as a people. We have experienced this starvation and this rotting away. And the most recent experience of going through this is the Holocaust. And this is the liberation of the Ebensee, Austria camp on May 6, 1945. Look at these guys. Don't you think they were numbed and appalled looking at each other? The soldiers who liberated this camp, they were numbed and appalled. And what's happening? These guys are skin and bones. They're rotting away. Many of these men died after liberation because they ate too much food too soon. You know, the GIs, thinking they were kind-hearted and thinking they were doing a favor, would bring in bread, and these people would grab the bread and just eat a handful, and their body couldn't take it. It'd kill them. Many died after the liberation because they didn't transition them very slowly into whole food, you know. So you see, it has happened in our history, even recently. And believe me, that is not the most appalling picture you can find of the Holocaust. I chose a rather mild one. All righty, so the point F, at the bottom of the page here. The point of all this, the teaching that he wants to bring to Israel, is the famine during the siege. Severe famine. The false prophets, they're saying, not to worry, it's not going to happen. Ezekiel, Jeremiah are saying, but it is. Get ready for it. And in 586 BC, the truth will be crystal clear. All right, with this we move into chapter 5 of the book of Ezekiel. And we come to the fourth sign, the fourth symbolic sign, the sign of the shaved head. And so we begin in verse 1. We'll take verse 1 in three pieces. First of all, first phrase in verse 1, chapter 5, verse 1. As for you, son of man, take a sharp sword. So he has to take some kind of a sword, but it's going to be used in two ways. And point B at the bottom is important. The sword is going to represent Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian armies. All right, so take this sharp sword, page 62. And here's the first use of the sharp sword. As for you, son of man, take a sharp sword, take and use it as a barber's razor on your head and beard. All right, so he's to shave all the hair of his head and all the hair of his face, okay? And point three in the middle of the page there, shaving in this manner in ancient Israel meant one of two things. It meant either point A, mourning, and you see six cross references that will establish that, or point B, disgrace. And you see two cross references for that. So if a man went around the way we look today in our Roman culture, he would be either expressing mourning or disgrace. And that's why you see the chassids in Israel going around with long hair and payas and, you know, beards and all that, because they're obeying this idea. Now Ezekiel is being told to shave himself, and this is even more significant in Ezekiel's case, because Ezekiel is a priest. Page 63, top of the page. He is a priest. Point four at the top of the page. The hair of the priest was a mark of his consecration. And these actions were forbidden to those functioning as priests, and you might add there, for clarity, in the temple. You didn't function as a priest unless you functioned in the temple. Now, two cross references, A and B. The first cross reference deals with the common man. This was basically a requirement of the Mosaic law for the common man, the layman, every man. You shall not round off the side growth of your heads, nor harm the edges of your beard. And that command is, again, you see that very clearly with the chassids today, with the payas, the long hair, the beards, you know, big full beards. They're obeying that command. But for priests, there was, again, a very specific command, Leviticus 21, 1 through 5, your second cross reference. For priests particularly, the Lord said, then the Lord said to Moses, speak to the priests, the sons of Aaron, and say to them, they shall not make any baldness on their heads, nor shave the edges of their beards, nor make any cuts in their flesh. So priests were not to participate in pagan mourning rituals. That's basically what all that is there. So we ask the question here. Was God asking Ezekiel to violate the Torah? No. Why wasn't he asking him to do that? He wasn't serving as a priest in the temple. He's in Babylon. He's not in Jerusalem. He's not in the temple. So if he was, point D, if he was serving in the temple, he would have lost his priestly office. He would have broken the law. But again, God is not asking him to do anything in violation of the law. Now, what is he to do with his hair? And by the way, point B there should read point C, I believe. So put a double parentheses, point C there, the division of the hair. I got some sharp-eyed morning class students spotting some typos. Okay, let's go on to the last part of verse 1. As for you, son of man, take a sharp sword, take and use it as a barber's razor on your head and beard, then take scales for weighing and divide the hair. Now, guys, Ezekiel didn't have a head of hair and beard like mine, okay? When I go to the barber, you know, she's got this little handful of hair there, this little tiny handful. But remember Ezekiel. He's got a beard like this and hair down to his shoulders, all right? They cut it off. They got a pile, all right, okay? Hair was worn longer in those days, not like today. Okay, so he's to take it off, and he's to weigh it. He's got enough to weigh there. And he's to divide it up in verse 2. One third you shall burn in the fire in the center of the city when the days of the siege are completed. Then you shall take one third and strike it with the sword all around the city, and one third you shall scatter to the wind, and I will unsheath a sword behind them. So we have three divisions of this hair. First of all, point A, he puts it on that clay brick, that clay tile that he's got in the middle of his living room, and he sets it on fire. It's in the middle of Jerusalem there, right? So he sets it on fire in the middle of the city. And then he takes point B, the next third, and he places it down on the ground, and he smites it with the sword that he has in his hand. Now, this is why his arm needed to be loose. Remember back in chapter 4, verse 7, lay on your side, but keep your arm free. Okay, he needed it to take the sword and strike the hair that he had placed on the ground. And then he takes the last third and he scatters it around the room. And the point here is that the city will come under siege, and some will die in the city. Some will die by the sword. And some will be dispersed, scattered around the room into exile, and persecuted in the dispersion. And we did suffer a certain amount of persecution in the dispersion. For example, the book of Esther outlines a time of persecution for us while in dispersion. Okay, verse 3, we on the top of page 64, the explanation continues. Take also a few in number from them and bind them in the edges of your robes. So from this last third, this third that's scattered in exile, he's to take a few of the hairs and bind them in his skirts. Now what God's talking about here is probably the lower extremities of an outer tunic or something that Ezekiel was wearing. You see, he had a girdle in those days. And you could take your outer tunic and you could wrap it up in that girdle and make a little pouch. So he probably tucked it up in his girdle and he stuck some of the hair in that little pouch. That's probably what happened. So that's probably where he kept it. But those hairs that he put in the pouch did not remain undisturbed. Verse 4. Take again some of them and throw them into the fire and burn them in the fire. From it a fire will spread to the house of Israel. So in verse 4, he takes a few hairs out of that pouch and they're removed. Some of them are, point 2 there, burned in that fire. And point B is the idea here. Some will escape Jerusalem, but though not all those escaped Jerusalem will survive. Some will perish, even though they escape Jerusalem. And so point E at the bottom, we have the point of this action, the results of the siege and the famine upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem. One-third will die in the siege. One-third will be killed by the warfare. And one-third will survive. But a portion of the survivors will die due to the Babylonian oppression. They won't make it. It won't be a permanent survival. So one-third will die during the siege. One-third will be killed during the warfare. One-third will survive, but a portion of those will not survive for long. That makes sense? Okay, well, this will be repeated in just a moment. All right, page 65. We come to the judgment on Jerusalem, verses 5 through 12. We'll start with verse 5. Thus says the Lord God, this is Jerusalem. I have set her in the center of the nations with lands around her. So he points to that tile in the middle of his living room, and he shows that it's representing Jerusalem. Now, what did God do with Jerusalem? Point B, I've set her in the midst of the nations, or literally in the navel of the earth. Now, this was not geographically true, but theologically, it was very true. Point C. Jerusalem is the theological center of the world. So it's true in the sense of significance, and it still is true. Jerusalem is still the most significant city in the world, no matter what the other nations of the world think. From God's point of view, Jerusalem is the key. And what was the purpose? Point D. The purpose was to testify to the righteousness of God. That's why God did that. But did we fulfill our purpose? And the answer to that is no, as we pick up verse 6. But she has rebelled against my ordinances more wickedly than the nations, and against my statutes more than the lands which surrounded her. For they have rejected my ordinances and have not walked in my statutes. Now, ordinances, point A there, are authoritative commands. And so God's authoritative commands were ignored. Point B, the word statutes is used. That's written law. Even the stuff which I wrote down was rejected. So both of these terms refer to the Mosaic law. And the point is that we deliberately disobeyed our covenantal obligations to abide by the law of Moses. We entered into a covenant with God to obey him, and we rejected that. Page 66 at the top of the page reveals the terms of the Mosaic law. Here are the terms that we signed on to. We'll start in Exodus 24:3, your first cross reference. Then Moses came and recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances. And this is, again, at the base of Mount Sinai. And all the people answered with one voice, and they said, all the words which the Lord has spoken, we will do. We're signing on to this agreement. Leviticus 19:37, God says, you're signing on to it? Okay, I'm going to hold you to it. You shall thus observe all my statutes and all my ordinances and do them. I am the Lord. So God is taking this seriously. Deuteronomy 4:1. Now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and the judgments which I am teaching you what? To know intellectually? No, to perform, to know and do. Deuteronomy 5:1. Then Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, hear, O Israel, the statutes and the ordinances which I am speaking today in your hearing, that you may learn them and observe them carefully. And finally, just to make sure we get the point now, Deuteronomy 6, verses 1 and 2. Now this is the commandment, the statutes, the judgments, which the Lord your God has commanded me to teach you, that you might do them in the land where you're going over to possess. So the first generation at Sinai is supposed to observe them, but does it just stop there? No, it doesn't stop there. So that you might do them in the land where you're going over to possess, so that you and your son, next generation, and your grandson might fear the Lord your God, to keep all his statutes and his commandments, which I command you, all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. So this agreement doesn't stop with the Sinai generation. It goes on down to Jewish people to today. Okay? All the generations of Jewish people, we signed on to the Mosaic Covenant. And so we come in verse 7 to the basis of the judgment. Verse 7. And we'll come to a close tonight with verse 7. Therefore, and of course, whenever you see the word therefore, what do? You read back and see what it's there for, okay? Therefore, thus says the Lord God, because you have more turmoil than the nations which surround you, and have not walked in my statutes, nor observed my ordinances, nor observed the ordinance of the nations which surround you, okay, because of verses 5 and 6, point 2, because you are turbulent. Now that word turbulent means commotion or turmoil. And this is the internal result of disobeying the law. There internally, the nation is not at peace. It's turbulent. It's in a commotion. And by the way, point 4 there should be point 3. This is a slight error there. Points 1, 2, 3. And then the next one should be point 4. And the next one, point 5. We got a Roman numeral missing there. So internally, the nation is not at peace. But then externally, there's an effect as well. Neither have you done after the ordinances of nations that are around you. And this is exactly what Ezekiel 11:12 will say when he's dealing with idolatry. But point B is the idea. The nation had gotten so bad that not only did they disobey the law of Moses, but they didn't even live in accordance with Gentile law. Okay, so internally, there's a lack of peace. The nation suffers turmoil and confusion. Externally, the nation is more immoral than the surrounding Gentiles. Have we testified to the righteousness of God? No. We've become rather an example of the degradation of sin. That's why God is going to judge the nation, because we have failed miserably. Again, this is another reason why I believe this is inspired. Nobody would write this about themselves and lift it up as holy writ unless it was true, unless God wrote it. We just wouldn't write this stuff about ourselves. Okay, and to me, you know, I look at our country around us and we're basically throwing off right and wrong with abandon. And so what's happening in our country? We're in turmoil in this country. There's no peace in this country. We're suffering the internal effects of rejecting right and wrong as well. All right, let's call it a quits for tonight. We'll pick it up next week on page 67 with verse 8. And let me close in prayer, and then we'll turn you loose. Our Father, again, we want to thank you for your word, and I, Lord, want to lift up this application that you've laid before us, this need to obey and to therefore be witnesses to your righteousness, just as Israel was to obey you and shine as a bright and shining light to the nations all around them. So each one of us is to obey you and be different and shine out as a bright and shining light in the sphere of influence you've given us, perhaps our family, perhaps at work, perhaps our neighborhood, who knows where. But Lord, help us to obey so that we can stand out and we won't go through the turmoil of rejecting right and wrong, rejecting your word, and that we can be a light to those around us. We need your power to do this, Lord, because this doesn't lie within us naturally. We need the empowering of your Ruach HaKodesh, your Holy Spirit. And so we ask you to empower us this week to be your bright and shining light. And we ask this in Yeshua's name. Amen. All righty, you guys. We'll see you next week.